Hey everybody, it's Matt. As we get ready to kick off this episode of Growing Greater, I invite you to join me and our team as we take the show on the road. You can be part of our studio audience on Friday, September 20th, when we interview Brian O'Neill. He's an inspiring entrepreneur and real estate developer, and he's going to share insights into his latest project known as the Discovery Labs. We'll be gathering at the King of Prussia location of the Discovery Labs, which is shaping up to be the first fully integrated environment where big pharma and high tech and emerging biotech can all cohabitate under one roof. We're going to kick off with breakfast and networking, followed by our conversation with Brian about his career and the vision he and his team have for the Discovery Labs. And then we're going to conclude with a tour of this novel office, wet lab, and co-working space. Join us as our guests. Friday, September 20th, 8 a.m., King of Prussia at the Discovery Labs. Registration is required, so head online to selectgreaterphl.com/event. Look forward to seeing you Friday, September 20th.
This is Growing Greater. Growing Greater. Bringing you the stories of economic growth, job creation, and business success from across the 11-county community of Northern Delaware, Southern New Jersey, and Southeastern Pennsylvania. Now, here's Matt Gabry.
From Wilmington, Delaware to Princeton, New Jersey, the Navy Yard to Malvern, University City to Horsham, and so many spots in between, Greater Philadelphia is home to dynamic entrepreneurs and global biopharma companies that are delivering advancements in medical research and new treatment options to help people live better and more productive lives. This fact, it's due in part to an unmatched clustering of world-class hospitals, medical schools, and leading academic researchers. It's really the perfect ecosystem to establish and grow a life sciences company. And this week on Growing Greater, we met up with Dr. Martin Phillips. He's the CEO of a company known as Obsidio, a preclinical biopharmaceutical company. They're developing treatments for fibrotic diseases. They're based out of Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, just about 12 miles west of Center City, Philadelphia. And their mission? Help to alleviate serious diseases caused by chronic inflammation, including things like chronic kidney disease, pulmonary fibrosis, scleroderma, and severe asthma. A medical professional and life sciences industry veteran with experience at the national and international level, Martin has navigated many challenging roles in diverse organizations. And here, he describes for us what it means to be leading his own shop.
Yeah, I've been training for this job for over 30 years, and I've sat at all the chairs around the business development table, but this is the first time I've sat at the head, and it's a lot of fun.
That's great. I love that perspective of you've been training for this particular challenge, this opportunity, this role as a leader of Obsidio, and that's where you are today. And a good place to kind of kick off here and to shape is one of my favorite spots is, how do you describe to the average person Obsidio?
Obsidio is a startup biotechnology company, and we are developing a technology that was discovered by three scientists at the University of Michigan. They discovered a very elegant way to attack a class of serious diseases that begin as chronic inflammation. In some cases, those turn to a spectrum of diseases we call fibrosis.
Mm-hmm.
So they had great scientific expertise in discovering a really elegant mechanism of disease that really nobody else had found before, and a very elegant way of developing a new therapeutic. And what we are doing as a team is taking their bench discovery and turning that into a drug that we hope will be useful for humans.
Gotcha. In several different areas, which we can dive into a little bit as well. Martin, I want to draw the connection between the University of Michigan and your role leading Obsidio from southeastern Pennsylvania. How does that connection happen?
Well, just within the last 10 years or so, it's become possible to run a company as a virtual company.
Sure.
Because we have high-speed internet, we have phones, we have cell phones. On the drive down here, I took a call from a vendor that we're using, which 10, 15 years ago was not possible. So I met these scientists through my network, and they happened to be at the University of Michigan, which is where I happened to go as an undergraduate.
Okay.
But we met, and they had this elegant solution. I happened to have some free time and some experience doing what needed to be done in the drug development arena. So we paired up, and it's grown to what it is today.
And there has to be a little bit more to that. I mean, I know some of it sounds like chance and luck encounters as well, but the whole fact that you recognized that they had stumbled upon something kind of, to use your term, if I remember correctly, elegant, an elegant solution to a health challenge. You know, some folks can look at some data, they can look at a situation or an opportunity and not see what other folks see. So you clearly were able to recognize something. They too saw it, and you were able to take that to the next level. And share with us the story of Martin Phillips, because you've gone from Michigan to Texas to Greater Philadelphia, maybe even a couple stops in between. And I'd love to kind of appreciate how you got to where you are today.
So I grew up in Flint, Michigan, went to University of Michigan in Ann Arbor as an undergrad. I went to medical school in Detroit at State. And then three friends and I were going to move to Texas together to do our residencies. One got married, one decided to take the lifestyle option and went to Colorado to do sports medicine. But I had already looked at Baylor and loved the setup there at the Texas Medical Center. So I did training there in internal medicine and hematology, ran a research laboratory with grant funding, then also worked at the University of Texas in Houston, ran the Adult Hemophilia Center in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
But then they turned the wick down on the NIH in the mid-90s. So I took a job here in King of Prussia, actually, with the company that became what is now CSL Behring.
Gotcha. And was that your entree, if you will, into the pharmaceutical biopharma world?
Absolutely. And it was a great entree. I thought I was going in to do research,
mm-hmm.
but I ended up on the business side. I had three great bosses. Then after a few years on the business side, where I really learned a lot about how pharmaceutical companies work, then I took over the clinical research function, which is testing the products in human clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed in that job until it was acquired by CSL.
Sure.
We left on great terms, and in fact, the CEO of CSL is somebody that I worked with when I was there 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I know today there's something special about CSL Behring, and it sounds like there was some roots planted even back when you were there in the late 90s of the culture that is flourishing today.
It is. That's very true. CSL Behring is a very good organization, and they've grown astronomically, but it's a very good patient-centric culture.
Yeah, for sure. And that's really important in not only doing the research and the development, but certainly the commercialization of medicines that help people live better lives every day.
Very much focused on people with rare diseases and serious diseases, and that really comes through in all their work. I'm very proud to have been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, a lot of what you were doing over your career has prepared you really well to today leading Obsidio. And I want to come back to that for a second, Martin. And I'm really intrigued by names. Is there a story behind the name Obsidio?
Well, there were three founding scientists, and that was one that the three founding scientists came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Latin for siege or battle, and it's about battling diseases. They were studying serious diseases of the lung, actually, but they came up with this elegant way of battling the disease. And it stuck. I like the name.
Yeah, absolutely. It is unique for sure. And when you share the background of its meaning, it's kind of really appropriate. And I know you've talked a little bit more about, you know, the focus of your organization, but I'd love for you to dive into, you know, kind of the therapeutic approach that you and your team are taking at Obsidio. There's a couple chronic inflammation categories, if you will, that you're focused on. And if you could talk a little bit more about that.
So acute inflammation is normal. Cut your finger, gets a little bit swollen and red, then everything heals over a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic inflammation occurs when a disease process, and there can be lots of different diseases that cause this, fool the immune system into thinking it has to continue to repair the tissues.
Mm.
And that can be an allergic phenomenon like severe asthma, or it can be various diseases that end up in a condition that we call fibrosis, where organs are replaced by scar tissue. And just like you get a scar on your hand when you cut it in acute inflammation, if an organ becomes replaced by scar, obviously it doesn't work well. So there's a disease called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never heard of it, there's no reason for you to have heard of it because it's a very serious disease, but it only affects about 25,000 people a year in the United States. Another disease that we're very interested in treating is chronic renal failure.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's due to diabetes or due to an inflammation of the kidneys, There are about 350 people every day who go on to dialysis in the United States, so about one every 5 minutes. And dialysis is a very difficult way for a patient to live. It takes a lot of their time and effort. It takes the family support to get them back and forth to dialysis. But the scientists who started Obsidio discovered a mechanism that's common to all of these diseases, which actually they put together different sources of information that had been known for 20 years, but they were the first ones to connect the dots and found out that a very common protein in the body called stem cell factor has two different forms. There's a shorter form, which manages a lot of what we call housekeeping functions, production of blood and hair color and other things like that. But then there's a longer form that is only present in chronic inflammation. And they designed an antibody, a monoclonal antibody, and we'll talk a little bit about what those are. And it recognizes just the difference between the short form and the long form of stem cell factor. So by recognizing that difference, it can leave all of the normal functions of stem cell factor intact, but only interrupt the abnormal function in chronic inflammation.
And I hope this isn't a silly question, Martin, but the discovery, if you will, of this antibody associated with the stem cell factor, were they looking for that, or did they kind of discover it by accident and kind of stumble upon it and said, hey, there's something here, and let's follow this path and see where it takes us in terms of providing a solution for, you know, fibrosis challenges in different kinds of conditions?
Well, these guys are really smart and really curious, and they were studying asthma and lung infections in asthma. And one of the things they found is that all of the cells in their animal models that were responding to these infections were responding to stem cell factors. So they just started following that string. And first they found out that by blocking the function of any stem cell factor, they could produce a desired effect and minimize the effects of these infections. And then delved further into it, looked at the kind of stem cell factor that they were working with, and they found out that it was only the long form. So it had been known for 20 years that stem cell factor was involved in inflammation. It had been known for 20 years that there were two kinds of stem cell factor, and they just kept pursuing this observation until they found out that it was the long form in inflammation and the short form that does all of the housekeeping duties. And then they had the inspiration to make an antibody against just the long form. Let me spend just a second talking about antibodies. These are biologic drugs. You see things like Humira advertised on TV, or quite a few of the new immuno-oncology drugs. These are laboratory-made copies of antibodies like your body would make when you go to get a vaccine. So when you go and get a flu shot, your body makes antibodies against the flu virus. But about 50 years ago, it was discovered how in a laboratory you can make an antibody like that against one very precise target. It has lock and key specificity. And by making an antibody against the difference between the long form and the short form of stem cell factor, they were able to make an antibody in the laboratory that interrupted inflammation while it left all of the normal functions of stem cell factor intact.
And that ability to target in a very specific way this treatment option, it sounds like it's really promising.
It's magic.
Yeah. So I'm jumping ahead here, but what's the long-term game plan here? Is it, you know, I know there's a process in terms of clinical trials and regulatory approvals and the like, but where do you see a treatment like this evolving in the next 3, 5, 10 years from now?
So we are just at the stage now where we are ready to begin manufacturing the antibody at a scale and quality that it can be used in humans. So far, we've just made small quantities to use in laboratory experiments, but now we're at the stage where we've made all the fine-tuning to the antibody that we need to make, and we have the one that we're ready to go forward with to manufacture.
And that manufacturing of an antibody specific to this treatment is really intended just for use in a clinical trial approved by regulatory authorities, et cetera, to see what kind of clinical data you get back.
Exactly. So the first thing we need to do is to manufacture it, and that actually takes 12 months start to finish and costs $7 million to make enough for the first clinical trial.
Right.
During that, we will do formal safety testing, or what we call toxicology testing.
Mm-hmm.
We've done less rigorous testing, and it's come up completely safe in small tests, but the regulatory authorities prescribe a specific kind of safety testing you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And those will merge in about 12 to 15 months, mm-hmm. and we will file what's called an IND, or Investigational New Drug Application, mm-hmm. with the FDA. And the best way to think of the IND is it is presenting to the FDA all of the data you've generated about the efficacy,
mm-hmm.
all of the records of how you've manufactured it to a very high quality, and all of the records about the toxicity testing, along with the what we call the protocol of how it will be used in the first human tests, because mm-hmm. the FDA's job is to protect the safety of human subjects.
Makes perfect sense. It really does. And I won't hold you to this, and I'm not sure if there's a standard or it's a requirement that's discussed and agreed upon with the regulatory community, but how large is the anticipated clinical trial study? How many people participate in that?
Well, there are several phases of clinical trials. The very first phase is often done in normal volunteers. That allows you to make sure that it is going to be safe to use in patients who have a disease. In addition, it lets you study how the drug behaves once it's given. How long does it last? How big a dose do you have to give? How often do you have to give the doses? And then that generally can be done in 12 to 20 patients,
mm-hmm.
or 12 to 20 normal volunteers. One of our challenges at this point is, with a mechanism that's so broad, choosing the right first disease to go in to try and treat. So we have several options for that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to get to the serious diseases like pulmonary fibrosis and kidney disease, and we may do some less severe diseases first in order to show the people who will be funding this, whether that's venture capital or pharma,
mm-hmm.
that this drug is safe and effective in a human disease,
right.
and it's worth investing the large amounts of money you need to treat serious long-term human diseases.
In a larger population as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. So folks, that's Martin Phillips. He's leading an organization called Obsidio. They're on a mission to develop human therapies to treat serious diseases that are caused by chronic inflammation, things like chronic kidney disease and scleroderma and severe asthma and a couple others. And it very clearly, Martin, you're in early stages. And I want to step back for a second, and I want to ask you a little bit about the characteristics of individuals like yourself and your partners who were at the bench at the University of Michigan, really investing time and resources into the scientific development of these kinds of antibodies. There's a characteristic that, one, it sounds like you need a lot of patience. It sounds like you need to have a high tolerance for risk. It also feels like you need to be able to navigate a lot of different paths here, whether it's a regulatory environment, a medical research environment, a business environment. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that type of perspective, especially coming from, you know, a pretty robust career that you've had, both in the research side and in the biopharmaceutical side of the house as well, working in industry, because you're pulling on all those kinds of characteristics, I suspect.
You summed it up very well. You do need a lot of patience. You need tolerance for failure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all worth it, because when we think about diseases that are not curable now, and some of them are fatal, people who die, you know, like I said, 25,000 people a year die of pulmonary fibrosis in this country.
Right.
Or 500,000 Americans are on renal dialysis, which means they're spending 3 half-days a week in a clinic or hooking themselves up to a machine every night. So when you think of an end goal of being able to impact somebody's life like that and either delay or prevent them having to go on renal dialysis, prevent somebody from having to get a lung transplant for pulmonary fibrosis, people ask me, well, you left a career in medicine to go into pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenges and rewards are actually very similar. It's just you're doing it on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I can see that's what gets people up in the morning who are working in this industry. You know, to be more direct, you're helping people. You're helping people live better lives. You know, when you describe the fact that they may not have to go on dialysis, or they can, you know, have fewer treatments potentially, or they can delay a treatment that's going to be really significant in a disruptive way in their life. That, when you step back and look at it and the impact it has on the quality of a person's life, is really motivating and inspiring for a lot of people.
Absolutely. As you say, that's what gets you up in the morning, because the idea that the end product of this work may affect a lot of people in a beneficial sort of way is, that's really what gets you up. Now, the thing that keeps you up at night is, how will I pay for it?
Yeah, and, right.
How will we get past this next hurdle? But it's a very exciting way to live.
As Martin and his team at Obsidio continue to navigate the research and regulatory milestones, we'll continue to track their progress. And their story is just one of the many innovative life sciences stories we have featured on Growing Greater. Check out other podcasts anywhere you get your podcast, or at selectgreaterphl.com/podcast. As we wrap this episode of Growing Greater, let's thank the team at WSFS Bank. We stand for service. That's the focus driving the work of the team at WSFS Bank every day. You know, their friends call them WSFS. And as the seventh oldest continuously operating bank in the United States, WSFS is a service-oriented, locally managed community banking institution. They've been servicing businesses of all sizes, as well as growing families, by offering a wide range of traditional and innovative banking services. Learn more about what the WSFS team can do for you at WSFSBank.com. And join me in thanking WSFS Bank for believing in us at Select Greater Philadelphia. Growing Greater is presented by Select Greater Philadelphia, a council of our Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Select is the business attraction organization for Northern Delaware, Southern New Jersey, and Southeastern Pennsylvania, and helps to grow the economic vibrancy of our collective community by attracting new businesses and new jobs to our region. Special thanks to our program producers, Elena Karmazin and Maricela Juarez, along with the great team of marketing and creative services professionals at our chamber. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in anytime and anywhere you get your podcasts, or online at selectgreaterphl.com/podcast.